Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hi, Tony, and hello, listeners, and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. You know, it's fascinating. I'm here with Tony, but normally we're standing side by side recording this intro, and we're actually on Zoom recording this from completely different places. And that is because, of course, we're in a situation that's completely unique and unprecedented. We're in the middle of a pandemic. When we recorded our episode, Tony, this was before this all came down. And here we are in a completely different situation.
Yeah, none of us could see this coming, Rob. And when we originally invited Shanti to talk about love and money, we really had no idea how important and timely this information would ultimately be. But we also didn't see how the context would be different. In this episode, we give some examples of buying Chinese food for example, or barbecuing, whether you have time to barbecue chicken at home. And now, if you find yourself at home in isolation or quarantine, then you have lots of time to cook the chicken.
Yeah, I know. The concept of love being home, which is, one of our mottos here on the Smart Family Podcast, has taken on a whole new meaning, hasn't it, Tony?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's what we just hope and dream for all of you who are listening. But we just wanted you to know that we thought about this episode. We considered whether actually this was too tense a time to talk about money. But because Shanti does such a great job of talking about how we need to have honest conversations and we need to talk about the values and the underlying fears and insecurities that drive our decisions about spending, that we thought there's probably no time better than this to raise this conversation.
I agree 100%. So let's introduce Shanti Feldhahn. She and her husband Jeff just wrote a book called Thriving in Love and Money. She is a best-selling author, a popular speaker, and really a groundbreaking social researcher. She got her graduate degree from Harvard and has worked on Capitol Hill and on Wall Street. And she now uses her analytical skills to investigate the most important surprises about the most important people in our lives, our partners, and in this case, in the context of money and finance. So we're excited to introduce Shanti. I think this is going to be a great conversation. Let's jump in.
Shanti, welcome to our podcast today.
I am delighted to be with you guys.
Yeah, it's so great to have you here to talk to us about the concept of love and money. Not the love of money, but love and money.
Love and money, exactly.
Yeah. So what you have done an extensive amount of research in the area of love and money. And in fact, you've written a book about it. And what actually led you to research love and money? What got you that out of place?
Well, I wish I could say it was because I was a money person, but unfortunately, it's probably the opposite of that.
Okay.
Because Jeff and I, honestly, we've done so much research in so many different areas of marriage and parenting, etc. And money was actually the one area we were personally not on the same page. And then it's sort of a long story, but we really recognized that money is one of these issues that really impacts marriages. I mean, it's in every survey that you do, every school that does a poll of parents, or every marriage organization that tries to help people. What do you want help in your marriage with? Money always comes out as one of the top ones. And it was, the one area we hadn't studied yet, and we were scared. Because it's one of those things like, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to actually confront this now. But it was 3 years later, thousands of surveys later, we are so glad we did. It has made a big difference for us.
Yeah. And how does your eventual work, I mean, you summarize your findings in your latest book called Thriving in Love and Money. How does it differ from, say, some of the other financial advice books or money management advice books that are out there for couples?
I'm not going to tell you to do a budget.
Okay.
How's that?
That's great. That sounds very appealing right off the start.
No, there are so many money management books out there, and they're great. And I would never write one of those because that's not my thing, right? That's not my giftedness. But to be candid, what we found is actually the people who can do the money management stuff and sit down and read the books, that's actually a fairly small minority of couples. And most people need help with something first, which is what we're working on, which is essentially what has to happen ahead of time. How do you even communicate to begin with as a couple? If you're having issues in your marriage around money, or if you have tension, or like me and Jeff, we didn't fight about it. We just sort of avoided the whole thing. Like, you're not going to be able to work on a budget. So there's nothing in there about budgeting or money management or getting out of debt. It's entirely about how do you have a great relationship around money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that sounds so valuable, Shanti. If we could ask you just on a high level, what would be your primary message that you would want us to take away from this research that you've done? It sounds fascinating.
It was fascinating. And honestly, there's one thing, like if you stop listening now, like just remember this one thing, which is if you are having any kind of tension or avoidance or fighting or whatever, irritation with each other around money, it's not about the money. It turns out it's about how money makes us feel and how it makes our spouse feel. And it's about a whole bunch of things running under the surface. All these kind of like expectations and worries and ideas of how things should work and insecurities, like there's all this stuff running under the surface that we don't even know is there. And we certainly don't understand our spouse. We don't even realize, like, I don't even know why something bothers me. Like if I am on my way home from a long day of meetings and I call Jeff on the phone and I'm like, hey, I'm just going to stop and pick up some Chinese food, you know, on the way home. And he goes, oh gosh, that's going to be $35. And, you know, we've got some chicken in the fridge. Mm-hmm. And that was like $12 from Costco. Like, why don't I just grill that? Like, why does that bug me? Mm-hmm. And it turns out the answer to that has nothing to do with money.
Wow. It sounds almost like you set out to do a research project, but in the end, the project started almost researching you. Did you ever feel that way?
Well, and it's so funny because we're all so different, you know, and it's, you know, Jeff and I are different people. And then there are plenty of people who are nothing like us. But that's one of the reasons that these research projects are so interesting is along the way, it's like, oh my goodness, that is why I do that. Or I never would have thought about it that way before. And then we quantify it. And it's like, okay, wow, 78% of other people have that weirdness. Right. Well, yeah.
I'm just curious if you can explain, maybe just in a nutshell, the method you used for your research project. Sure. Just so we have a bit of an idea of how you approached it.
Sure. We the short version is all of our research projects start the same way, which is we're basically investigating a question, one question. And this is what is underneath our responses to money and marriage that's either causing us to thrive or not around that area of our relationship around money. And so we're investigating it. And essentially, we just start out by doing tons of interviews, tons of focus groups. We're social researchers, so I literally, I feel bad for whoever is trapped next to me on the airplane for 2 hours because I'm going to interview them. You know, if somebody's bored and they're reading Sky Magazine, they're fair game. And we're just asking questions. Tell me about your marriage. How do you handle money? Do you love it? Do you talk about it? Do you fight about it? You know, just those questions. And then we start developing hypotheses. We start going, wow, I think this is a pattern. I think this is going on. And then Once we've done all of that, we do these big nationally representative surveys. And with those surveys, that's where we get really rigorous. And we work with these big survey companies. This is all led by sort of a guy named Chuck Cowan, who used to be the chief of survey design at the Census Bureau. He's worked with all of us, with us on all of our surveys. And that's where we end up with, okay, this is common to most people, this isn't. And it lends itself to being able to go through the findings and to go, you know what? I'm in the 80% here, not the 20%. But on this one, I'm kind of in the minority. Like, this doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of go through it and sort of figure out, where am I? Where's my spouse? And suddenly it lends itself to, oh my goodness, I just didn't know. And now that I know, it makes a huge difference.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I personally like reading Sky magazine, but I'm sure I would have turned around and talked to you about this topic, because it does come up. I mean, I've been married now for 20 years this year, and money does come up in our relationship all the time, and it's so important. You actually, let's talk about the stats for a minute then. Let's talk about the research, because you break down the percentage of couples who communicate well about money and those who don't. So what do your stats tell us about those couples?
Well, we actually found that only 23% of couples can talk well, communicate well about money without difficulty or awkwardness or avoidance or whatever. 77% of us can't. And it's actually was really interesting, because some of us think we can and we're deluded. Because one of the things we found in the surveys, and this was consistent across all of our different surveys, it didn't matter the age, the racial background, the religious background, the socioeconomic background, like this was the case across all of them, was that there were tons of people who said, oh yeah, we communicate fine around money. And then later in the survey would say, oh, but we keep separate bank accounts because every time we try to talk about money, we start fighting. It's like, okay, well, you know, that's not actually what we're talking about. We're talking about a great communicative relationship around money. So only 23% really have that capacity. Everything's fine. They talk about it. But 77% of us, we have some issues.
Well, what are those issues then? Like, why is money such an awkward topic? Or why is it such a private topic, it seems like? It seems like we all want to earn money and spend money, but none of us wants to talk about money, especially to our closest partners.
Which is the weirdest thing, isn't it? Like, yeah. You would think it would be that would be the person who's easy to talk to. But no, and it's because of what I mentioned earlier, that it is not about the money. It's about all this other stuff running under the surface. For example, the Chinese food analogy. I didn't realize until I did the research, this is just one little silly example, right? But I didn't realize until we did all this research that when I'm irritated, you know, what's underneath that? Well, it's because in my mind, without being able to articulate this, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, we've been so busy and we haven't had any family time for weeks, and our daughter's playing volleyball and our son's running track. And you know what, if we grill the chicken, I mean, yeah, sure. It's nice of Jeff to offer to do that, but there's going to be all this preparation time, and then he's going to have to cook it. And then, yeah, we eat it, but then there's cleanup, and then we have to start homework. And it's $35 to buy this like precious hour of family time. You bet. Like, absolutely. Like, that's what I'm thinking. And I wouldn't have been able to sort of articulate why I'm irritated that he didn't want the Chinese food. And on his side, and this is the case with actually a fairly substantial number of people who have sort of his viewpoint, which, by the way, this is not gender related. It just happens to be in his case. But often on his side, the thought is, you know, if you keep getting Chinese food like this, we're going to be homeless in retirement.
Right.
You know, there's kind of that, there's that feeling. Now, are both of these are totally legitimate thoughts and feelings. It's just I wouldn't have been able to articulate mine, and he wouldn't have been able to articulate his.
Right. So how do you address that topic then? So obviously, it's not about the money. It's about other factors.
And lots of other factors. That's just one. And really, honestly, recognize that you're addressing it. It's a small thing, right? It's just a minor thing. But these little minor, silly little things, these are the things of which marriage conflicts are made, right? It's usually not the big issues. So what we tell people as a sort of a starting point, now that we've gone sort of this whole cycle and had this whole arc ourselves in our marriage, is recognize you're having a knee-jerk reaction to something. There's something going on. Stop yourself. It's not about the money, right? And start going, what is underneath the surface? What is it that's hitting my spouse clearly differently than it's hitting me? There is one of those factors. We identified five of them. It turns out there's five completely different things potentially going on under the surface. And it could be one of them. It could be two of them that are being hit. Like, you don't know. But recognize one of those things is probably at play. Step back and go, okay, this is probably something that matters to my spouse that doesn't matter to me, or vice versa. And suddenly it takes it out of the realm of this big sort of emotional blow up that we would have been heading towards.
Right. Okay. So now you've raised this, the five sort of themes or areas of subconscious thoughts that tend to run beneath the surface and what's really going on. Can you just tell us about those five major areas of values? Yeah. Or can I call them values? Are they subconscious thoughts?
They're factors. They're the factors running under the surface of any money issue in marriage. Really is so, and these were the ones that we quantified that really matter. There are probably tons of factors running under the surface. These are the ones that tend to get in the way the most.
Yeah, okay.
The top five.
Yeah.
So the way we put it is these are the five findings, basically, is what we were talking about in the book. So the first is that it turns out that often I'm not valuing what my partner is valuing.
Okay.
Like, I don't realize it, or they're not valuing what I'm valuing. Like, we don't realize that we have two different things that matter, and we're just not seeing it that way. And I can give you some examples of that in a minute if you want. The second is that it turns out that there are probably, we have different fears or insecurities that are kind of running under the surface. We don't really recognize that they're there, and we really don't recognize that our partner's fears are as sort of magnified in their head as they are, because they're not ours. So it doesn't bother us the same way.
Okay.
And so that's a big sort of emotional thing, big picture thing. Then the next one is actually one that affects every marriage, every relationship to one degree or another. And that is, there's something in each of us that's really resisting being one in marriage, and it's coming out in how we handle money. Because, you know, it's kind of, we all know that marriage is meant to be, it's not just me and you, it's us.
Right.
And we have to be us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's something in us that's like, I don't want to be us. I want to do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. It's coming out in how we handle money. And we don't see it. The fourth thing is actually a technical difference that is very commonly triggered in how we process and communicate about money decisions. Like, and it turns out this is actually related to some differences in brain wiring, and it's often a triggered thing we don't see. And then the fifth one is that it turns out that we sometimes, this is not, you know, in every area, but quite often, if there's something going on when it comes to sort of an issue with irritation or whatever, that there's this weird like knee-jerk reaction that we're having to what is essentially like faulty beliefs about our partner or about money or about the situation. And whenever you have sort of a strong knee-jerk reaction to something, this is where we say statistically, it's really common to like, look and see if maybe you're having one of these sort of faulty assumptions, and that will help you kind of think right about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. That is a lot for us to unpack.
Yeah, so, we're probably going to get to all five of those.
No. But what about that part you said about how we often don't value what our partners value? Can you just explain a little bit more, maybe give us some examples of how that works practically?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways that this works because there are so many different types of values. Okay, silly example. Do you value time more than money or money more than time? Like Jeff and I will sometimes, like I recognized, we're going to go to a movie as a family. And it was one of the new Marvel movies because we are Marvel nerds. I will admit it. And so he said, well, when we're in the car, he's like, oh, so where are we going? And I said, oh, we're going to this theater over here. And he was like, why are we going to that one? And I said, well, because it was the one where we could reserve the seats, the individual seats online ahead of time, instead of having to go over here and stand in line for an hour
yes.
to get seat. And he's like, but that's $2 a ticket. I'm like, but that's totally worth it. And he was a little irritated. Like, it's just a little thing. But he's like, I wish you would have asked. Like, thanks for doing that. But, you know, we had some expenses with our kids. They had some athletic expenses that had sort of come out of nowhere. There was some budget. He's like, you know, we should have talked about it. And I'm thinking that's a perfect example of I was valuing not having to stand in line for an hour.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And he was valuing I would rather have stood in line for the hour. So we're just different people.
Yeah. So is that the same concept that say, you know, I value experiences. So I like to spend money on, say, vacation, right. Whereas somebody else might, or my wife might value things, or say, like,
correct.
I feel good when I go clothes shopping or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Like, it's just, there are so many different ways that this plays out. I mean, there you can have the, you know, I value a process for making money decisions, or hey, I value, like, this is a this is another common thing in our household where Jeff will want to try the sort of DIY way of doing it first. Like, he wants to try to do it himself. Where I'm like, can we get a professional? Like, because I hate to admit it, but in my head, I'm like, can we get a professional to do it right the first time? He's like, who says I'm not going to do it right the first time?
I can see where that one goes.
Yes, you can. And this is again, this is not gender related. You know, there's plenty of people where the wife would be the one who values doing it DIY, you know, to save the money. It just happens to be that, you know, I tend to be more like, no, let's go for the professional right now. And those examples, there are dozens and dozens of those types of examples. We've categorized them to some degree, but the one thing that they all have in common is that we all have them because by definition, we are two different people. And so certain things are going to matter differently to me than to you. And so it's just going to happen to some degree.
I'm just going to say, like, I feel like I'm relating more to Jeff right now. Because I am like the DIY guy. I'm like, hey, let me try that first. I actually enjoy trying it first. Please let me try it first. That is valuable to me. So I'm just going to say that on the record. That
exactly.
And why is Jeff not here actually talking with us right
now?
I feel like I'm kind of ganged
so
up on. I'm just kidding.
I didn't start fighting. I don't know.
So you've mentioned as part of your research that you found that we use money as an antidote to our insecurities. Yeah. And so what does that mean really? And can you unpack how that plays itself out in marriage?
Yeah, I know everybody listening just went, what? No, see, it turns out, let's back up just a little bit, because one of the things that's was a big aha moment for me, as we were kind of seeing what we were starting to see in the focus groups and such, is that we tend to have two different sets of insecurities running underneath the surface to begin with. Like, we don't, even before we get to the antidote, like, how do I combat those? We tend to have different insecurities from our partner. This is actually one of the areas, there are very few areas that were gender related, because, you know, men and women were just as likely to be spenders and savers, for example. Like, that was literally almost 50-50. It was like 47% and 53% or something, you know.
Pretty even.
Very even, and within the statistical margin of difference. So, I mean, very even. And in this case, though, there were some really substantial statistical differences between men and women. And this was overall, this was not 100%, but in general, somewhere between, depending on the survey, 75 to 85% of women tended to fall into one category, and 75 to 85% of men tended to fall into a different category. And by definition, that means, you know, if 75% of men said one way, 25% didn't, obviously. So the key is kind of figuring out, where do I fit? Where does my spouse fit?
Sure.
But it turns out that we tend to have, men and women tend to have different fears and insecurities running under the surface.
Around money in particular.
Well, in general.
Okay.
In general, overall, and it's coming out in how we handle money. And this is where we tend to use money as an antidote to those insecurities. It's just, I don't realize when Jeff is doing that, because I don't see him being sort of trying to stay away from a particular fear that he has. Because why would you be afraid of that? So here's the sort of the picture that we use. This might make it clearer to people. It's almost like the word picture is, picture that you're afraid of heights and you're standing on the edge of a cliff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know that feeling? It's sort of, for anybody who has a fear of heights, it's kind of like the feeling like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be like magically pulled over the edge. Like, I'm gonna, you know, be pulled over the edge. It's pulling at me and I'm not going to be able to stop it. And so you try to, you back away. Like, because that's the only reasonable thing to do. So you're not, you don't have vertigo. And you get really irritated when your spouse, who doesn't have a fear of heights, is like, hey, come on to the edge. Let's take a selfie over here. It's a great view. And it's like, are you nuts? Like, how right. Can you do this? You think you're going to die, right? Well, it turns out men and women have two different cliffs, so to speak. For men, statistically, the cliff is like this feeling like, am I going to be able to provide for the family? Like, that's the fear. That's the worry. That's the insecurity. Am I going to be able to provide? Am I enough to provide? And they feel like they're constantly, like, it's in the back of their mind, like, I'm being pulled towards that edge and I'm worried about it. So as a guy, I'm trying to stay as far away from the edge as I possibly can. Like, And so classic example, to the point that's almost stereotypical, but statistically it was huge, was so that men are more likely to feel this need to, I need to put in extra hours at the office. Like, I need to, you know, I was talking to a woman recently whose husband is a police officer, and he was accepting all these extra overtime hours. And she's like, but you're missing all of their son's soccer games. Like, or his basketball games or whatever. Like, he was just, and he's like, I know, but, you know, this is good. You know, I'm building up the tenure at the office, at the police office, you know, precinct, and putting in, getting some extra money for college, and he's working to stay away from the edge. Well, it turns out that it tends to be that women see a different cliff, see a different edge. Like, yeah, the money is there. That's an issue. Of course, everybody thinks about it. But for her, she's feeling pulled towards this edge. Like, I hardly see you, and you're never seeing Blake's basketball games, and we're not together as a family. And like, it's like this feeling like I'm going to fall over the edge of suddenly our family not being close, and our son is not feeling loved, and, you know, feeling pulled towards this edge. We're not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And for the two different people, the real issue is that I don't recognize that Jeff really, truly has a fear that he's not going to be able to provide for the family. Like, that's a real thing. I'm like, really? Like, that's a thing? That's, you're seriously worried about that? And he's like, really? Like, when we're upset as a family and we haven't talked in days, and, you know, I've been upset and distant, and I drove away mad the other day. Like, you're actually worried about us? Like, that's a thing? Like, we just don't realize. And the other thing, so what we're doing is we're trying to use money to stay away from the edge, because let me tell you what this woman was doing who was married to the police officer. You know what she wanted to do? She wanted to have more family dinners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And out, yeah. And do vacations and do things that were generally costing money. Well, guess what? That's pulling him towards his edge. And so the key is my efforts to stay away from my edge sometimes make yours worse, and we don't realize it. So we just have to talk about it.
Yeah. Shanti, how much does this have to do with how we were raised? Because we all come from different family backgrounds.
Yeah.
You know, one partner might come from a more affluent background. The other might come from much more of a, you know, depressed background from a economic perspective.
Yeah.
How much does it have to do with how we were raised?
Well, you're going to be interested in this. Because this was not what I was expecting to find at all. As we were getting some of the survey results back, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. It was really interesting. It has almost nothing to do with how they were raised. It has to do with how they responded to how they were raised.
Oh, interesting.
You could literally have, and this is, the fears and insecurities were actually statistically gender correlated far more than anything else. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about with how we're raised and how we responded to it, those tended to have impact on our, what we value. And it's what you care about. And it was interesting. This one of our very first focus groups as we started this, or excuse me, sets of interviews, sometimes we do interviews that are arranged for us where I will say, okay, I'm going to be in Minneapolis speaking at a women's leadership conference or speaking at a church or whatever. Part of the contract would be, I'd like you to arrange 5 interviews with random couples.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to know who they are, you know, like just random people that I would never have met otherwise. And this happened where literally within 45 minutes of each other, this husband and wife sat down and the husband said, well, I was raised really poor in downtown Minneapolis or wherever this was. In downtown Minneapolis, I was raised really poor and I never want to feel that way again. So I save everything. Right? Like I'm the big saver. I never want to feel that way again. So I try to compile it and be careful with it. 45 minutes later, the next husband sitting down goes, well, I was raised in downtown Minneapolis really poor. And I never want to feel that way again. So I am all about enjoying life. And I am all about, like, I never want to feel poor again. And so we go out to eat because I never did that as a kid. And I want my kids to be able to do that. And I'm thinking going, oh my gosh, this is so perfect. Like it, and we saw statistically, it has nothing to do with your background and everything to do with how you responded to it.
Wow. That's
fascinating.
I wouldn't have predicted that, yeah. But your research shows it.
Yeah.
Shanti, how much should couples combine their finances, you know, when it comes to bank accounts, et cetera? Or even should they have separate amounts of money to spend, you know, discretionary spending? You talk about couples acting as a team and really being fully one on the area of finances. Is that part of it?
Yes. So if you're talking about that whole issue of we're no longer just you and me, we're us, right? There's a third entity, it's us. And you talk about, well, should we have separate bank accounts? Honestly, I have gotten to the point, having seen all the numbers come back in the research, I literally have gotten to the point where I'm answering that it depends on if you want a good marriage or not.
Okay, say more about that.
Seriously, because we all already have a tendency, like I was saying, to sort of resist being us, right? To resist that sort of real oneness, you might say, and kind of do what we want to do. But marriage, by definition, is two people who are supposed to be one and are supposed to be that sense of us, which means that you can no longer fully be these, you know, two people who do what they want to do. Like, of course, you're going to have to come together and compromise and understand what each other needs and put the marriage first in some ways. Like, that's now the preeminent thing. Somebody described it. I love one of our interviewees described it as almost like you've created a baby, like you're nurturing the baby. The baby is the marriage. You've got to put attention to it and nurture it. It's something you've created, the two of you. And to do that, if you have, and this is very common, this is about, 42% of couples, I have to look up the number, but something like that, where it's like, yeah, my paycheck goes into my bank account and your paycheck goes into your bank account. And hey, could you send me the money for the gas bill or, you know, whatever? You've institutionalized, you're two different people. There's not, it's not an us, it's still two different people. And it is so statistically so crucial that you go, okay, maybe we still have two different bank accounts for convenience, but I can see everything on yours. You can see everything on mine. We go back and forth because there's no longer your money and my money. There's our money. And we jointly decide on everything together. And yeah, you know, sometimes you are going to do, like, there's plenty of people in our interviews, for example, where one person in the couple was like a spender and not good at saving. So they put a savings account over here that they couldn't access quite as easily. Like, they were still on it, but wasn't as easy for them to access. But they decided that together. Like, this was the us deciding it. We're deciding it together. And that creates the oneness. That creates what the marriage is. It is really powerful once you stop putting barriers in place to your marriage.
How big of a factor is the financial compatibility, let's say, let's put it like that? You know, when you think of a couple coming together, thinking of becoming an us, you know, we think about, okay, well, you like this and I like this, and this is my idea of what, you know, family might look like down the road. And we have, we kind of consider all these things that would make us work. How important is our outlook and our view of money and spending and just our financial situation in that decision?
Well, you know, to some degree, it's extremely important. And to some degree, it's also just a choice. Like, in everything in life, there are going to be things that you're just going to have different values, right? Like, I want to buy the movie tickets ahead of time and you don't.
Right.
And am I willing, it's really more a choice. And am I willing to sort of say, no matter what, I'm willing to put us first and come together, because that is what marriage is really in the end. I mean, if you break it down, that is what it is. Where I'm willing to put the other person's needs ahead of my own, even if I need to, and in order to prioritize that. And that's often one of the things that we've seen. Money brings that out more than almost anything else in marriage. It's one of the most obvious ways that you can see that at work. And the good news is that because of that, it's also one of the greatest opportunities for turning money from an opportunity for conflict to being this incredible opportunity for connection and intimacy and togetherness. I mean, Jeff and I are so much closer, or even a couple of years ago when we were still in the middle of this project, because there's so many things that we just didn't realize that we had all these walls we had to tear down between us.
Right. So if anything, it enhanced your communication as a couple.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it sounds like it enhanced your connection too.
Oh, definitely. And I can guarantee that if people really try to understand themselves and their partner, and as they go, okay, we're married, where is it that we're not being the us, right? Where is it that I'm being me and you, that's your money and my money? And taking that kind of scary step to say, no, that's our money. Like, just because I made it, you have just as much right to say what we should do with it, because it's our money. You will see this dramatic difference that comes up, because you have to get into a completely different emotional and mental space to prioritize this togetherness in marriage.
What you're saying is stop treating it like some kind of black box in the corner that we can't touch. Let's just be open about it, transparent about it. And yeah, it's going to probably bring up some insecurities and some things that we feel uncomfortable about, but just addressing those is going to bring you closer together.
Yeah, absolutely. And in it, honestly, one of the things that we found, and this is one of the main reasons I sort of feel like we were supposed to write this book, is that it's not rocket science. Like, in the end, it is really simple. It's just, I didn't know this stuff was down there in me and was down there in him. And if, to the degree that I can, and I'm imperfect and he's imperfect, we all are. But when I understand this, I can love him better and he can love me better. And suddenly now I'm understanding stuff I just didn't see about him before. How can that not lead to more intimacy?
Right. So Shanti, I know, I don't know if I've shared with you that I've practiced family law, or in U.S. terms, as a divorce attorney. And so I saw so many people who reflected what you've researched, but unfortunately from the angle that they couldn't get on the same page with money. And, and often it was a case where one person in the couple did actually have a very strong emotional sort of resistance or barrier to either being open or sharing power with decision-making over money. So there could be some listeners who really need an edge, like they need a strategy to work on, getting to this place where they can thrive in love and money. Can you give us some guidance on a strategy?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of sort of simple things I can suggest, and then sort of a bigger picture step. So probably the most important thing is to confront that fear that's in your mind, because that's what's behind it, right? And if you think about it, it's an irrational fear, because in most cases, now this is not 100%, right? But the vast majority of cases, you're not talking about dealing with a gambling addiction, right? So that your spouse is going to gamble away the life savings. And if that is the case, which, of course, there is a small number of people for whom those sort of big issues, those big dysfunctions are an issue. Everything we've just said needs to be handled completely differently, right?
Sure.
That's somebody who needs to be guided down a specialized track. But for the vast majority, you've got a husband and wife who care about each other. And they have goodwill towards each other. And they're trying to love one another well. And so it's this irrational feel like somebody's going to control me, right? And if you think about it, and that's just one way of putting it, But if you think about it, of course I have to give up some control over my life. I'm married. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, yep. That's kind of the definition. Like, again, I'm no longer just me. I could have been just me and living in my own little apartment alone.
Right.
But I'm not. I have this other person. And wow, that's so cool. But it means that there are things that we have to be willing to meld on. And so the question that when I would say, like, what's the fear behind it? And how much of that fear is irrational? Do not live according to your fear ever, because you're going to make decisions that in the end will bring about the biggest result that you fear. Like, for example, maintaining separate accounts because I don't want them to know what I have, and I want to have this little independence. And my mom always told me, you know, got to keep a little bank account on the side just in case he flakes out on you, right? Like that sort of that fear, you know what? That's going to build a wall and create a lack of trust. And at that point, you're actually creating the problem you're trying to protect yourself from. So you're asking those questions about what you're fearing and confront that. And then ask yourself the biggest question, which is, which should you fear more? Which is the biggest problem? Is it having somebody handle money in a way that you wouldn't agree with here and there? Or is it losing your marriage and causing problems? And I will tell you, honestly, some of the best insights that we've ever had in this whole research project are from people who had been through a divorce, were now remarried, and were going, yeah, we did it wrong before because we were giving into fear. We were so worried. And now we've seen how traumatic it is to lose that. We are never letting that happen again. So we are going to open ourselves up. We are going to come together. We are going to prioritize us no matter what, because that's the greatest thing to fear. And I would say, let's just reckon with that so that we don't get to that point to begin with.
Wow, I love it. Shanti, just as a pediatrician, I have to ask this question, because what are some one or two things that we can pass on to our kids to really promote this idea that, you know, money is okay to talk about. It's not something to be feared. And finances, what are some healthy things we can pass on to our kids in this area?
Well, since you are a pediatrician, I'm going to say something that you probably have said many times to many parents, which is model good behavior. So, I mean, truly the greatest thing that your kids will learn from is watching you and how you handle stuff. And if you're not talking about money or you're fighting about it, well, guess what? They're going to learn that money is this big, like, scary thing that you fight about. If they see that you are trying to honor one another and respect one another and are open to talking about this, even when you just completely disagree, but you're able to talk about it in a kind of calm and, like, okay, I understand where you're coming from. Here's where I'm coming from. Let's go your direction on this or come my direction on this one. They're going to see that. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's any one thing that you can do to, like, I don't know. You can't really change your personalities, and your kids are going to be wired in certain ways and value certain things just like you do. But you can actually notice and start appreciating, oh, it looks like this is how you're wired. Like our daughter, for example, she is more like Jeff. Uh-huh. You'll appreciate that.
Yep.
When you're saying, you know, I'm thinking I'm liking Jeff here. Yep. And our daughter is like her dad. Mm-hmm. And she's very frugal. And so there's stuff to appreciate about that. To say, you know what, since we're putting you through college now, I really appreciate you being frugal. Having those conversations. So that's the big, I think, to the degree that they, the right age and all those kinds of things, to me, it really is at every stage, model that behavior.
Oh, that's so good. Shanti, I'm sure our listeners will want to connect with you and find your resources. How can they do that?
Well, everything is on our website, which is thriveinloveandmoney.com. Thriveinloveandmoney.com. And it's not just the book. There's an assessment totally free that will help you as a couple kind of go, where are we starting? Where am I starting in love and money? What do I need to work on? And just all sorts of other resources. So that would be, I think, where, you know, it might be kind of fun to start there. I think if you go through the book, what we really recommend is go through the book about yourself first. Read it about yourself. Read it with a pen in hand. And yeah, highlight the, yeah, I do like the DIY, you know, to try to do it myself first before we pay for a professional. And then you each do that. And the fun thing is when you read each other's comments, you're getting a personalized tour into this is your spouse's heart and mind around money.
I love it. Well, thanks again, Shanti, for your insights. We really appreciate it.
Yes, Shanti, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you guys and what you do.
Well, Tony, I just love that conversation with Shanti. What struck you or what was the most surprising thing in our conversation with Shanti today about love and money?
Well, I was surprised that there were basically two categories of insecurities and actually that they aligned according to gender. I would have thought there might be more diversity. Mm-hmm. So that was surprising. How about you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just love that example that she gave when I asked about, you know, how you were raised, whether that had an impact about your view on money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And she did, you know, set the example of like how two people growing up in similar circumstances, for example, maybe in more poverty circumstances, how they might act completely differently or have a completely different attitude towards money.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't the home environment. It was how the person responded to their home environment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So I guess what it just boils down to is like, what better way to grow intimacy and connection with your partner than to really try and understand, you know, what their values and fears are around money.
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us today. You can connect with us on Instagram at Smart Family Podcast, all one word, and at our website, smartfamilypodcast.com. There you'll find our show notes with regards to this episode and all of our previous episodes as well as some blog posts. And feel free to leave a comment there. We'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review.
So thanks for joining us at the Smart Family Podcast, where it's our aim to help you build family relationships that last, cut through the noise to focus on what works, and boost your parenting to the next level. Why? Because we want to help you love being home.